Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with New York Magazine editor John Homans about dogs.
People have always thought of dogs partly in terms of their deaths, which is a cruel but true observation. Updike wrote quite a bit about this.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Alan Kozin revisits the world of Kurt Weill and Lotta Lenya.
You listen to one of his pieces, instrumental or vocal, and it absolutely has a signature that tells you that it's his.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. John Homans is one of the best-known and most respected magazine editors in New York. He's also got a new book. It's called What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. It's reviewed for us by Walter Vatter, who says it's an engaging and informative book that is both a survey of the latest research and a memoir of John's years with his lab mix, Stella. And I'm going to throw you off right now by telling you the words you never want to hear from someone like me. 6 weeks ago, our beloved dog died.
Oh, that's terrible.
And you're going to help me understand why it really is as if I lost my best friend.
It is. And this is something that even Stella's five. And it's something that I think about even now. I mean, I think everyone kind of measures their lives by dogs that they've loved and lost. And people have always thought of dogs partly in terms of their deaths, which is a cruel but true observation. Updike wrote quite a bit about this, that he said as a footnote in one of his two great poems about the death of dogs, that one reason people have dogs is to bring death into his house, which is a cruel observation. But the death of a dog is in a lot of ways more complicated than the death of a person, because you're left wondering, what was it exactly that you loved, and why was this creature, it's not a human creature, why was this so important? And so those are the kinds of questions I explore in the last chapter of my book.
Right. You bring a lot of science into it, and you go to an institute, I think, in Vienna. And what is it that scientists or experts are discovering, or what are they uncovering about these fascinating, remarkable creatures?
They're interested. Science. Darwin was a dog lover, and it informed all of his research. The Victorians were passionate about dogs. England had a cult of the dog, and they thought of dogs as the most human of creatures, of animals.
And in some ways, they are right. Dogs look you in the eye. They follow direction.
They look you in the eye, and they're better. And scientists now have put, for a long time, scientists retreated from those kinds of ideas. But now there's a movement to examine really what it was that made dogs so fit so neatly into human society. And some of these scientists, a guy named Brian Hare, who's a Duke, is kind of the leading and also the most controversial canine scientist. He and one of his professors at Harvard were talking about why chimpanzees couldn't understand a human point. If you point to something, a chimpanzee won't understand that.
Right, they don't get it at all.
Brian Hare said, "Well, my dog can do that." And then this scientist, Richard Wrangham, who's a primate scientist, said, "Prove it." And so he did a series of experiments where he found that dogs, in fact, are, it's controversial, but dogs are much better than wolves at understanding human pointing. And it's because a chimp, smart as they are, and they're obviously much smarter than dogs, is not a cooperative.
Chimps are smarter than dogs, and we mean like their
pure
brain power.
Cognitive, you know, kind of sense. They have more brain power, but they would never believe that another creature was trying to help them. Like if you reach for something, they'll try to grab it first. But if you point to something, they just won't understand that you want to help them. But for a human, a point is the first gesture that a human baby, the linguistic gesture that a human baby makes and can understand. A one-year-old human baby can understand that. And a dog,
right, because they'll follow your eyes.
Because they'll follow the point, and they'll understand that we're pointing at the same thing. If you point at the banana, they have a banana in their head. The dog doesn't have that quite, but the dog does understand. This is what was developed in the development of the dog. It was scientists like Hare thing. What the dog does understand is that you're ready to help it.
And is that developed over time? Is it because we have this very long relationship, thousands of years
with
the dog?
It probably developed rather quickly. That is associated with animals that are less aggressive and have less of what's known as flight distance, like they don't run away as quickly. And so how the dog probably developed is that the wolves that were more comfortable being with humans were, you know, eventually separated and became dogs. And it turns out that, the change that allows animals to understand human pointing happens rather quickly. They tested these famous Siberian, Hare tested these famous Siberian foxes and found that when they're selected to be less aggressive and less afraid of humans, they also develop this ability to understand pointing. So it's kind of an emotional development.
Oh, I see. So you can take a dog-like creature out of the wild and pretty quickly they'll get it.
If you select for the least aggressive and most friendly to human creatures, then eventually, fairly quickly, in a number of, you know, 10 generations, you will have a creature that can understand human pointing, because Hare was actually surprised that these foxes, which had been selected for tameness, could understand pointing, and they also had all these dog-like characteristics. They were what's known as Nyatnyas. They had piebald coats, and they had the whole range of dog-like behaviors. They had barking, and there's a suite of characteristics.
And what about the sense of fidelity and loyalty that you see in dogs right away?
I think that they're probably, I mean, the wolf is a very loyal and friendly creature to its fellow wolves. What's happened with a dog is that it's easier for them to translate these qualities onto humans, basically.
Because I remember when we brought our dog home from the animal shelter, and just so our listeners don't feel too sorry for me, I mean, this was a dog, a mix, who lived almost to what we established, my daughter did, as we gave her a birthday. She lived almost to her 15th birthday. Mm. So we had her for a really long time.
Yeah, that's a good long life.
And that happens with, you know, mixes. They're tough, and she was kind of a lab terrier, pit bullion sort of thing. But so we had brought her back. She was a little over a year, and a neighbor came to the house. We'd probably had her at that point for less than a week.
Right.
And it was a man who came to the door, put his hand on my shoulder, and she growled. So obviously she's doing this sort of protective watchdog thing right away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that something that is just inherent for
I mean, dog? I think I didn't treat this so much in my book, but I do think it's inherent. I mean, I think that there are creatures that love their own, you know, and it happens in any family. I mean, the other is the other, and I think that that's the same with dogs as social creatures. I mean, they're the most loving creatures that you can imagine in their own families, and they're incredibly vicious, which is to animals outside their circle, which is fairly similar to humans.
Okay, so we've done some of the science, we've done some of the history. You got to tell me the politics.
We went out to the North Shore Animal League, which is
on
Long Island, which is a great place to get a dog. And we had sort of decided that we didn't want a pit bull, and I'd heard that there were only pit bulls in New York and up at the shelter on 110th Street. So we went out there, and Stella is from Tennessee. And I found that a somewhat surprising fact. And when I began to research it, I learned that a lot of the dogs on the East and West Coast are from heartland states or from red states or from the South and from the West and from states that have different animal ethics and animal ethics that are closer to, the old farmyard ethic where the animals you loved, you preserved, and the other puppies you drown in a bucket on with a faucet. That was the way that dogs lived on farms for generations.
How do they end up in New York?
The specific story, North Shore, I mean, they were one of the first no-kill shelters, started in the 40s, and they were a shelter that took in lots of stray dogs from New York City and from Long Island. And then by the mid-80s, because of spay-neuter and because dogs were leashed and because, unleashed dogs have been a huge problem, and finally it was dealt with, by the mid-80s, the supply of dogs on the East Coast that people wanted to adopt had dried up. And so a guy named Mike Arms, who was the head of operations for North Shore, made a connection with someone in South Carolina who had, because they were killing, down there, they were killing 80-90% of their dogs that came into the shelters, puppies, anything. And so he said, well, this is the situation. We can take these dogs, and there are people on the East Coast here in Long Island who want these dogs. That's more and more has been the situation. I think if you go anywhere, if you ask anyone, if you see a dog that's not a pit bull in New York City, in Massachusetts, in anywhere on the East Coast, chances are it's going to have come from the South or even Puerto Rico where dogs aren't spayed or neutered and there are no leash laws. And so dogs have a, you know, have a chance to breed. Because really, and I grew up in the suburbs in Massachusetts, and there no dogs were ever on a leash, and few dogs were fixed. And, you know, our dog has several litters of puppies. Well, that just doesn't happen in a place like that anymore.
Wow. So New York turns out to be this kind of unexpected purple state where blue humans cohabit with red dogs.
It's a transaction that the blue states have with the red states, basically. The real dog overpopulation problem in a city like New York, and in most cities in America, actually, is pit bulls. And this shelter at 110th Street, the ACC shelter, can be almost 100% pit bulls.
Why?
Because they're dogs of the poor. And they're dogs that are people use them to make money, breed and sell litters, and the ones that they don't sell end up in the shelters. They are the dogs that don't get fixed, and they're the dogs that tend to be allowed to roam. And this sort of dog ethic has not penetrated in those places. And organizations like the ASPCA are making tremendous efforts to try to stem the number of pit bulls. Because some people like to have their dogs want the dogs to have all their equipment, all their testosterone, because a tough dog is one thing that you might want if you live in certain quarters of the city. They have a program where you can tie the tubes of the dog. You don't cut off its testicles. You just tie its tubes so it has all the testosterone, but it can't make puppies. And so there are things like this. And the other thing that the ASPCA has to do, and they're the shelter that is responsible for, in order to create a diverse inventory and have so the people come into the shelters, they bring dogs up from Tennessee as well. So they bring dogs that aren't pit bulls up from Tennessee in order to bring in customers that then may decide that they want a beautiful pit bull. And they've done a tremendously successful job in selling rescue dogs to the point where, you know, most of the people I know would prefer to have a rescue dog rather than a purebred dog.
This is a question that's probably impossible for you to answer, but I have to ask it anyway. Do people generally treat dogs better than they did, say, a generation or a century ago, or don't we really know?
I mean, I think that there are two sides of the coin. I mean, I think that, you know, you'll find more dog birthday cakes than you did when I was growing up in the 1960s. You'll find more dogs sleeping in the bed. I mean, that would have been a shameful thing that no one would have admitted. I think you'll find more dogs getting cooked delicious chicken and not having to eat kibble. You'll find many fewer dogs that have to sleep outside. You'll find more dogs with coats. And I think there's certainly more concern about the welfare of dogs. But on the other hand, I think that in a lot of ways, and so some of the older dog scientists believe this, that a dog that's not on the leash, that's living in the country, that there are trade-offs where the old world of dog, for certain dogs, was a pretty nice thing. I feel guilt all the time at having Stella, who's a fantastic athlete, cooped up in my apartment. And rather than doing what I know she wants to do, which is be off the leash in the countryside. And, you know, and dogs are, there are more dogs than ever that are living in cities and they're living cooped up. And, you know, this is why dogs in cities often end up having to be medicated because they're not built for apartment life. They're social creatures. They're not built for you to be away all day. They don't want you to go to work. By the nature of our modern life, in some ways, they're not being treated better. But by the same token, we're more concerned about them, I think.
Well, there's a paradox of modern life.
Yes, right? Yes.
We care more even if we're not doing so well.
Yes.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Sam. That was fun.
That's John Homans, whose new book, What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend, is reviewed in this week's book review. Leslie Coffin's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Sam.
Well, you know, back in the day, I remember talking with some of your distinguished predecessors, Motoko Rich and Julie Bosman, and we charted the demise of Borders.
Right.
And the big player left was Barnes & Noble, but I understand they're not doing so well either.
No, holiday sales, very, very disappointing. Not only were retail sales down in the stores, and you know Barnes & Noble's is the nation's largest book chain right now, not only were same store sales, retail sales, down by about 10% over the 9-week period last holiday season. Much more scary, Nook sales, and Nook is their digital device, their entrance into the very competitive digital world, were down 12.6%. So
this is over the holiday again?
Over the 9-week holiday season. But boy, that's talk about the important season to play in, and that's it.
Well, you know, Leslie, it's interesting because when Barnes & Noble introduced the Nook, it really seemed a lifeline because many prefer it to the Kindle. They say it's really a better reading device. What happened? Is it some of the new players that have come in?
No, here's the really interesting thing. So it started as e-readers, which are basically something you could just download digital material. And now the whole world's moved to the tablet. And you can do, of course, you know, with the tablet, you can do music, you can do video. It does a lot.
So does the iPad.
The iPad, the Kindle Fire. And apparently people or analysts will tell you the Nook put out a great product. And not priced too badly either. Amazon put out a Kindle Fire, a tablet, that it very much underprices.
Oh.
But Barnes & Noble puts out a Nook tablet that got great critical reviews. People will tell you it's a terrific product. It's not actually about the product. It's about the relationship to the company you buy it in. Whose digital library do you get locked into? Whose digital music are you locked into? So if you already have tons of iMusic, you want an iDevice. And it doesn't matter what Barnes & Noble is offering you, as it turns out.
So if you have this expanded, improved, tabletized Nook, that still doesn't get you all that other stuff that you get through the Kindle Fire.
No, apparently not. And we've been watching, really for a while, Barnes & Noble struggle with this. About 9 months ago, they said they saw the Nook as their future. They were expanding overseas. Sales were pretty good. But in 9 months, that's really fallen apart. They had a very strategic partnership with Microsoft that I think they thought might save them. Microsoft came in and bought a good chunk, 17% roughly, of the digital unit. They gave a lot of cash for that. And I think that what they had hoped was Microsoft would promote them through their Windows 8 platform. And that relationship has not turned out to be so good. And we're not sure why, whether Microsoft dropped the ball because God knows they're having trouble enough organizing their own life, whether communications weren't good, whether Nook is just a low priority. But that hasn't brought in the support and the people they need. And in the meantime, the relationships with Kindle and Amazon and iTunes are developing and becoming very deep, and they're going to be harder and harder to shake over time.
Okay, so right now, where does Barnes & Noble stand, and what are the possible scenarios? What are they looking to do? We're not talking about going out of business, are we? Or might we be?
Well, some people are saying to me this is going to turn out to be one of those real points in their history where they have to struggle. So Barnes & Noble still is the nation's largest retail chain. Sales were down, and more worrisome, foot traffic was down. And this comes at a time that independent bookstores are saying their traffic and sales are up. So we're still analyzing why that is. Some people say to me Barnes & Noble's, when they went digital, just didn't put their effort into the retail division that they should have. That's one theory. Another theory is that they will have to take the Nook into a different direction. They got money from Pearson, as you know, recently.
The big publishing.
The big educational. They do a lot of educational. There's some thought that they'll try and make an educational niche, that they won't be a tablet for everyone, but they'll be particularly good if you want education.
So maybe in classrooms.
Right. Classrooms, they'll be given to students. They'll have a lot of educational content, and they'll build themselves out that way.
Boy, it shows you how times have changed. When I started working at the Book Review almost 9 years ago, the biggest player by far was Barnes & Noble, and Amazon was kind of an upstart, and now the world's just been turned upside
down.
It's
really true. When I remember when Amazon was Barnes & Noble was considered the predator, driving independent bookstores out of business. They were hated, and now...
Right, you've got mail.
Right. And now, look at them now.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thanks.
Kurt Weill and Lotta Lenya had one of the most remarkable musical relationships and relationships otherwise in modern history. There's a new book called Love Song, The Lives of Kurt Weill and Lotta Lenya. It's by Ethan Morton, who's written many, many books, and it's reviewed for us by a great critic and culture reporter here at The Times, Alan Kozin, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you.
Okay, so Weill and Lenya, these really remarkable figures, where do they come from? How did they meet, and how did this incredible collaboration begin?
Well, actually, he was born in Germany. She was born in Vienna. And she was beginning a career as an actress. He was already making some headway as a composer of music for plays. I think he wanted ultimately to be an opera composer. She wasn't exactly an opera singer.
Now, are we talking about sort of Weimar Germany? What period is this?
It was during the Weimar period. And they met when I think he was casting one of his shows with his collaborator, who I think at the time was Georg Kaiser. And they began kind of a romance. I mean, he was immediately taken with her, and they became, people think of them as being inseparable, but they were actually quite separable. when he left Germany in 1933, he went on his own. I mean, he was Jewish, and she was, I think, raised Catholic. And so she didn't, I guess, feel in immediate peril. And in addition, I believe she was in the middle of an affair with another singer. So their marriage was a bit dicey at the time. He went to Paris, and then eventually to America, and she followed, and they got back together. But they apparently both had affairs all through their lives, which is one of the things that Ethan Morton discusses slightly more than in passing, but he doesn't really dwell on it. But he does clarify what their relationship was.
Now, let's start with Weill. Most of our listeners will identify him, also associate him also with the great genius, really, Bertolt Brecht. Where was that relationship? Had Brecht and Weill become a partnership by when Lotta Lenya entered the scene or not? She was a part of all that too, right?
She was. They worked together on and off for a long time. And, that too is one of those relationships that seems on the surface to be very tight. I mean, their names are almost inextricable. They really disliked each other fairly immensely. And Ethan Morton dislikes Brecht especially.
Didn't everybody sort of dislike Brecht? Wasn't he very difficult?
He was
person?
A very difficult man, and he had a very interesting conception of literary property, which from his point of view was that everything was his and nothing was anybody else's. And there were a lot of transactions throughout their career together, and even way after, when Brecht was living in East Germany and wanted to revive certain works without...
This is East Germany, so this is the Cold War.
Right.
And, Brecht was, something of a communist. Was that a problem or not? A difference?
Well, they had a difference of opinion there. Brecht was really quite a character. I mean, Ethan Morton describes him in the most egregious possible terms. I mean, he calls him the sort of literary crook of the century or something like that. I mean, he's quite down on him. And sometimes his descriptions of Brecht are actually kind of comical. Weill was more of a, he was happy to be in America, whereas Brecht...
And he really had a flourishing career. First, let's just briefly for our listeners, what are some of the really classic songs that they'll know, the Kurt Weill and Lotta Lenya collaboration, some of the real classics going, back to the beginning?
Brecht, Weill, and I'm going back and forth between Weill and Weill because
that's kind of what they did.
Yes, it's an important thing. When he lived in Europe, he used the name Weill, which is the way it would have been spoken in Germany. Once he fled, with the Nazis on his tail, basically. Moved to America, he adopted the American pronunciation of the name and was very resolute about wanting to be called Weil, not Vile. So it makes it difficult to talk about, because when you talk about his early career, his name was Kurt Weil then. Now it's in America, it was Kurt Weil. With Brecht, I mean, he collaborated on the Three Penny Opera, and the songs everybody will know are, you know, Mack the Knife and Pirate Jenny. And
what were Lotta Lenya's characteristics as a singer? I mean, she was really a remarkable figure.
She was a remarkable figure. I mean, she had a voice that was, you know, it was definitely not operatic. It didn't have that kind of polished, smooth sound. It may be too much to say it was raspy, but, it was a little bit. She was more of a Germanic cabaret pop singer, the way we think of it.
So she was a unique cabaret singer, collaborated with in Germany, Weil. They came over here in the United States after persecuted by the Nazis, and then really had a second career that was really successful, a Broadway career.
Right. He immediately adapted to the Broadway style, but the Broadway style was actually not that different from what he was writing with Brecht and Kaiser and other people in Germany.
And you say that actually making the transition to Broadway was not that difficult for them because there were parallels or similarities with the German musical.
Right. Well, you know, basically the pieces that he was writing with Brecht were semi-operatic, semi-theatrical works where, you know, there were distinct songs just like in a Broadway musical. And he was writing in a style that was, you know, he wasn't writing 12-tone music like Schoenberg or any of the really sort of avant-garde formal composers. He was writing cabaret style music with classical underpinnings. And that suited the Broadway style at the time as well. And he had some hit shows, Lady in the Dark, Knickerbocker Holiday, Lost in the Stars.
And are they revived much, Alan?
They're not really revived very much. In terms of his music, the things that are revived most are Mahogany and Three Penny Opera. Lost in the Stars gets a production now and then, often by in an operatic guise. You know, keep in mind as well that he came to America not so long after Gershwin and Porgy and Bess. And, so basically there was almost an exchange between classical music and Broadway at the time. There was this idea also, you know, Giancarlo Menotti was writing Broadway pieces that could be operas and operas that could be Broadway pieces. Things went back and forth a lot.
And audiences were ready for this. I mean, these were not hard sells to those audiences.
They weren't hard sells. Basically, if you can have a hit tune like September Song in a Broadway show, that's going to, make it a hit.
And what's Weil's reputation today, say, among other composers?
His reputation today is almost entirely in the classical music world. I mean, the only things of his that are known very well outside the classical music world are things like Mack the Knife and Alabama Song.
The Doors
did Alabama Song, and everybody has done Mack the Knife. I mean, you'd have trouble picking one. You know, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Bobby Darin, and they're all
that's a real became a real standard.
That became an absolute standard. That probably is his most successful song. So everybody knows that, and I think most people who know the song probably know that he composed it as well. But in the classical music world, a lot of his he wrote a lot of other music that was not theatrical too. He wrote a violin concerto that's quite beautiful. He wrote two symphonies that are quite good. He wrote some chamber pieces, and those do get performed a bunch now. Not as much as they should. There seem to be waves, in the mid 1980s. 80s, there was a big, or around 1980, 81, 82, there was a big revival of his music where people dug up some of these early pieces that hadn't been performed much and added them to the repertory. And then it went away again, and then it comes back periodically. I think at this point with recordings, there are now so many recordings of his chamber and symphonic works, as well as Mahogany and Three Penny Opera and song collections, that I think he's pretty established in the 20th century classical canon, not really as a trailblazer in the instrumental works, in the sense that the 12-tone composers got a lot of attention, and then later the minimalists, which was way after his time. But you don't think of him as the head of a school. And yet you listen to one of his pieces, instrumental or vocal, and it absolutely has a signature that tells you that it's his. It has a certain kind of melodic accent that was really all his own. Where he was probably ahead of his time, I mentioned this in passing in the review, is that these days, among the younger generation of composers, you have kids who grew up listening to rock and roll, listening to jazz, and then going to school and studying the more formal sides of music and writing classical music that combines all of those things. In a way, that's what Kurt Weill did. In his early years, too. He was very open to jazz, which at the time was a new form. But he was also a formal composer who was interested in the latest developments, and he combined those things in his music. So in a way, he's sort of a granddaddy of everything that's happening today.
Thanks so much, Alan.
Thank you.
That's Alan Kozin, who reviews Love Song, The Lives of Kurt Weill and Lotta Lenya in this week's book review.
I tell you, we must die.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Sam.
All right, so have we really entered the age of stability on the bestseller list?
Yeah, one way to look at it is that there's just not that much exciting readers right now, and so they're not buying new books. Another way is that the books that have already made the list are just so good that nothing new is cracking it. There's only one new title on either hardcover list this week. It's on the nonfiction side of things at number 12. That book is called A Higher Call by Adam Makos with Larry Alexander. It's a World War II story, kind of a companion volume to Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken, about a fighter pilot who was shot down in Japan. Of course, that's Unbroken. A Higher Call is about an American fighter pilot whose plane was hit over Japan. The pilot lost altitude. Most of his crew was killed or badly wounded. He fell to about 1,000 feet above ground and was flying over a German airfield at the same moment that a German fighter pilot was taking off. The German fighter pilot saw him, went on the attack, started chasing him. When the German pilot realized how bad the damage was to this B-17 bomber, he took sympathy. He was close enough that he could see the surviving crew members trying to stop the bleeding and repair the plane while it was in flight. And he couldn't believe kind of the heroism of these pilots and their persistence in continuing to fly, even considering the huge damage to the plane. And so he escorted them to safety, tried to get them to land in Germany and surrender, or tried to escort them to Sweden as the next best option. But instead, they made it across the North Sea all the way back to England. And eventually, the American pilot, almost 50 years later, was able to track down the German pilot, and they became friends for the last almost 20 years of their lives.
That's quite a story.
It really is.
Was it much reported or reported at all at the time?
It wasn't. When the American pilot landed, he told his superiors as part of the routine debriefing what had happened, and they were amazed. And immediately realized that if word got out, it could jeopardize future trips. It could make American pilots let down their guard over Germany. They didn't want anyone to know that they're, you know,
who knew the Germans and Nazis were such nice guys?
That's exactly it. You know, you have to demonize the enemy. And if word of this kind
of, a bunch
of
softies.
This act of valor came out, then they had to suppress it. And so they did suppress it. The American pilot, his name was Charlie Brown, didn't reveal it until he was giving a lecture about his wartime experiences sometime in 1986. And somebody asked him, what's your strongest memory or what haven't you told anyone? And suddenly he remembered this story and he told it and realized, I have to find this guy. And he wrote into a combat pilot's newsletter. The German pilot turned out to be living in Canada after the war, and saw this in the newsletter, reached out to him, said, I'm the guy, knew details of it that he couldn't have known unless he really was the guy. And so they reconnected in 1990, and they both died in 2008, and they became fast friends for those last 18 years.
That's a tremendous story.
So we know a lot about the American pilot. What do we know about the German?
Well, on the German side of things, too, of course, the story was never known because it's an act of treason. He had the enemy in his sights. He could have fired on him. He could have brought the plane down at any time. And instead, he led him back to safety. And so it was a story that he could never tell because he would have faced court-martial and probable execution.
You might not want to march into the room with Goering, Hitler, and Goebbels and tell them this particular anecdote.
That's right.
So that was kept secret, too, and it just emerged so much later.
Yeah, strictly from this coincidence. The authors ask, the German's pilot name was Stigler. What if he had stayed in Germany and never learned how to speak English? Then he never would have known this guy was looking for him. They never would have reconnected. We wouldn't have had this kind of amazing capstone to this story. It would have just been an anecdote told by the American pilot.
That's tremendous. Okay, thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.